recognition. But the strike solidified solidarity among area workers and demonstrated the capacity of labor to organize work actions across industrial lines.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So like I said, yesterday was Pardon and Clemency Day. Blago, DeBartolo, Milken, Carrick, and Pogue. Oh, boy! and I'm still, the Pogue thing, I'm still wondering how much Trump pocketed for that pardon. But again, you know, this is all about a guy who is very self-serving. Just incredible. And here to share some thoughts on, well, the top news of the day and everything we can bang around. I've asked our good friend Sarah Kenzior to come back and share some thoughts with us. She's an incredible writer, fantastic author, also the host of Gaslit Nation. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us. Oh, she's gone. Oh, my. You'll have that. It's one of those things that, you know, technically, you know, things just go awry during live broadcasts. But, you know, the Pogue thing, a couple hundred thousand dollars over the last, over the 2 year period that went into Trump PACs, went into free airfare. Because what's better than having a little slush fund? And I guess, you know, another reason why you look at the, the clemency for Blago and the perfect phone call. Anyway, we got Sarah online for Sarah. Thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So what did you think of yesterday's clemency and pardon day? What'd you think of the perfect phone call with Blago? What'd you think of all that mess?
I mean, it was expected. This is what he's been doing ever since he pardoned Scooter Libby. And I think it's part of a broader agenda to normalize white-collar crime, normalize the kind of criminality that Trump, of course, has engaged in for decades, that his cohort has, paved the way for future pardons of Roger Stone and Paul Manafort. So, it's appalling, but it's not surprising. This is, of course, the way he operates. And, of course, just like Bill Barr, he needs to show that he's above the law.
Yeah, do you buy any of the Bill Barr's on the hot seat? He's going to resign. Do you buy any of that BS?
No, this is like watching WWF. Like, I cannot believe that people are still falling for this. And I'm actually kind of gratified to see that people finally aren't, that they're not like, you know, they were with Sessions, like, ooh, it's a feud, it's an internal dispute. They see, you know, that this is BS. They see that this is a lot of nonsense, and they see the way that, you know, papers like the New York Times write these kind of headlines of court intrigue tales in order to try to mask autocratic consolidation with contrived chaos. That's what they've been doing from the start of the Trump administration, and they're still doing it now. Only finally people see through it, but it's a bit late in the game.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I look at this, and Barr coming out with the, Trump tweeting is making it harder for me to do my job. Yeah, it's kind of hard to cover things up when the guy who you're covering it up for keeps saying, "Yeah, I did it."
I don't even think he doesn't care. Like, all of this stuff, you know, the tweets, the rallies, I mean, that's just like fodder. That's just, you know, food for the teeming masses. What they actually care about is getting away with corrupt plots. And the way that they get away with it is by literally rewriting the law so that they are no longer breaking it, by officially proclaiming themselves and their whole operation above the law. So, you know, whatever Barr is doing to sort of, complain to the public or shift the emphasis to something like Trump's tweets is to move it away from, you know, money laundering, from illegal deeds, from what happened during impeachment, you know, whether it's the Ukraine shakedown or the broader plot with Russia or Deutsche Bank. Like, they want all of that to be swept away and the focus just to be on theatrics.
Yeah, and to highlight that, I'm sure you saw this yesterday, that basically Trump said, "Hey, there's a new sheriff in town, and it's me," because evidently he claims he's the chief law enforcement officer of the U.S.
Well, he also claimed he was the king of Israel and, like, the chosen one of God. So, I mean, he claims to be a lot of things. And, you know, It's just, it's posturing. He's excited because nobody has held him accountable for the 3 years that he's been in power. I honestly don't think the, you know, sham Senate trial acquittal is what prompts these sorts of statements. He's been making them from the very beginning. He's been making them, in fact, from before he was elected. And it's the continual refusal of people to do anything about it, people in power to do anything about it, that gives him this confidence. It's the cumulative effect. And unfortunately, you know, the Democrats are continuing to submit to him. They're refusing to impeach Barr, for example. And the Republicans capitulated to him long ago and are, you know, complicit in his illegal activity. And so that is, it's a very discouraging moment, and it's not surprising that he's ecstatic about it, because Trump likes it when everyone is in a, you know, kind of catastrophic state of mind, and he can, you know, flaunt his own perceived victory in people's faces.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that goes back to, you know, 2015, and a lot of the talk that I had with people about, you know, his management style is chaos, and he likes pitting people against each other, and we're seeing this play out over the last 3 years, and no one should be surprised over it.
I mean, he loves chaos in terms of personal disputes. I mean, he literally ran a game show that was designed on that, designed on firing people, designed on playing off people's emotions. He did it with the tabloids, but more disturbingly, you know, this is a guy who, like, basically got off on 9/11, who, when the Trade Center collapsed, his first reaction was to joyfully declare that his buildings were now taller.
Yeah.
And when the financial collapse happened in 2008, 2007 in the real estate market, to say that he was really excited because people were going to lose their homes, the economy was going to tank, and then he loves it when this happens. And then, you know, again in 2014, he went on Fox News and said that America would go back to being great when everything collapses, when there is riots, when there is total chaos, and then praised Vladimir Putin. So yeah, he's pretty out in the open about his lust for catastrophe, and not just sort of like the game show WWF type, WWE, I'm never going to get past the fact that they changed that, WWE type stuff, but the, you know, the bigger things, the really serious crises that we face as a nation. He likes those. Those give him a little thrill.
Yeah, it's where he can be the tough guy.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah, and he's playing that for all it's worth. I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, today the story broke about Julian Assange and Russia's Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, who the White House claims never had any contact with Trump. They never discussed anything with Trump. You buying any of this Assange stuff?
I mean, this is an old story that just seems to have been reconfirmed. Like, this story broke in 2017, and Rohrabacher has been somebody who has been you know, working with post-Soviet dictatorships for just as long as I've ever known who he was, and not just Russia, but also Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, you know, a lot of the most authoritarian republics. And we also know that he was connected to Assange. Rohrabacher is one of the people that Kevin McCarthy said was paid by Putin. He told Paul Ryan this, and of course the other person he said that was paid by Putin was Trump. So yeah, I mean, I think that this is a credible story, you know, that Rohrabacher and Assange were working with Putin, you know, directly or through a proxy to help get Trump elected. I mean, that's pretty basic stuff. I'm kind of curious how the Assange case will go forward, what exactly he'll testify, because they usually have a counter narrative in place, you know, just like with the election, they're like, oh, Russia didn't really do it, it was Ukraine, you know, they're going to come up with some sort of thing. And I don't know exactly how closely, you know, Assange and the Trump camp are working together at this point, but I don't think that there's actually a break there. I suspect it's all still, you know, one, you know, intertwined operation.
So you think that there was an idea floated to pardon Assange, as long as he was, you know, willing to say Russia had nothing to do with it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's possible. I'm not exactly how that would work through international law, whether, like, Trump actually, you know, can wield this kind of power and what it means for Assange in other countries. I think the deals were struck so that Assange would give a certain narrative, you know, to whom that may vary. But yeah, I mean, I think that there are a lot of little trades being met. I still want to know whether Paul Manafort visited Assange, in 2013. That was reported a couple of years ago. There's been very little follow-up on that. I think it was Luke Harding in The Guardian who reported that, because this web seems to, you know, it goes way back before the election, as we know, and Assange's involvement does as well. And you know, one of the interesting things about Assange to me is that when WikiLeaks first appeared, he spoke about wanting basically to take down Russia and China and other authoritarian states and expose their inner workings. You know, in Russia, you know, the Kremlin was extremely angry about this. And soon after that, he switched and he suddenly was appearing on RT and praising Putin. And so I've always kind of wondered how exactly that happened. And I know people that had initially been working with WikiLeaks left after that point because they saw him as somebody who was aiding dictators, which is what he is. And then I think they saw him more clearly later as someone who was working directly with Russian intelligence, you know, which he also is. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. But, you know, it was an interesting story today. And one, as you've said, that has been out there for a while, especially since Rohrabacher has been floating this for a while. And I do find it interesting that the White House spokesperson, this Stephanie, whatever, Grizz, whatever, something, she came out and said, you know, Donald Trump knows nothing about it. They never had any conversation. They never talked about it. And yet there are documented meetings between the two of them where you go, somebody knows something. Maybe they're tapes.
Yeah, I mean, we're at this point where I'm sort of thinking, well, like, okay, even if this comes out, who is left to investigate it? You know, that's what differentiates this time from, say, a year ago when the Mueller probe hadn't yet folded, when impeachment hearings had not yet happened, and when the House hadn't basically ruled out future hearings, which is what Pelosi has done. I don't think she's backed up by other members of the House in this. I think they still want to investigate. They still want to pursue accountability, but they're blocked. And so when I hear of a revelation like this, I just think, who is left to investigate it? They've purged the agencies. They've packed the courts. The DOJ is just Trump's, you know, personal legal service. And they're threatening, you know, reporters on top of that. And so, you know, unfortunately, then it does go back to, you know, House committees, Intel committees, and so forth to try to get to the bottom of this. But they're not showing any sense of urgency. Everything is kind of structured around the election, which is it's just an idiotic move. We've never had the time to wait for something like that. It doesn't have a certain outcome. The impeachment hearings were being held because Trump was trying to rig the election, which he also did in 2016. So, of course, you should not count on the 2020 election being free and fair, or being some sort of solve for our problems. Like, you can just postpone them until January of 2020. Like, that is absolutely not going to work.
Yeah. I can't wait for January 20th, 2021 at 12:01. And hopefully there's a new president that we can start cleaning up this mess, but you're right. Nothing's certain. But you know, here's the thing, you hit on it a second there. You know, there's a purge going on. I mean, today we see somebody else being ousted because, didn't agree with Trump. He's been asked to resign quietly. They've been, or not even quietly, and they fired Alexander Vindman and his brother. They went after some 70 other people. There is a massive purge going on, and all you're going to have left are the loyalists and the sycophants.
Yeah, and that's a very predictable route of autocracy. That's why it was essential to investigate him and stop him and put limitations on the actions of the administration very early on. But instead, they spent all that time just sort of being like, gee, is he connected to Putin? What could it be? Or letting, you know, even though Trump had, of course, confessed it multiple times, as had Donald Trump Jr., as had multiple people in his fold, or they waited for Mueller and they let Trump run out the clock while waiting around. And so, yeah, I mean, it's very frustrating because there are a few people left. And people should take the firing of Vindman and his brother as a very dire, very serious sign, because this is exactly what happens in authoritarian states. They don't just target you. They target your family. Yep. Because they know there are patriotic people who will sacrifice their career or even risk their lives on behalf of their country. But what they don't want to risk is their family's safety, their family's security. And so this was just an incredibly cruel and brazen move. And I'm glad you brought it up, because a lot of of people aren't even talking about this anymore. It's like they forgot that it happened. They forgot that Vindman himself, you know, someone who came originally from the former Soviet Union, you know, and whose family had faced persecution there. That's why he came here, was removed. It's just an unbelievably tragic story. And I hope that people remember what he did. And I hope people remember, you know, what he and his brother have experienced in return, and that they stand up for them, and that they have, you know, the Vindman brothers' backs.
Yeah, you know, the thing that gets me is, you know, he was mocked when he said that he took that moment and said, "Dad, I'm going to be okay. Everything's going to be fine." He was mocked for that. And I guess fortunately we in this country don't understand that mentality of government going after people, but Vindman did. And he had to know that if things didn't go the right way, he was going to be the target, as well as, you know, whoever his brother and whoever else.
Oh, I think he absolutely understood that, and I think he said that because he knew what was going to happen, and he knew later that that quote would carry a kind of poignancy. You know, it was basically a challenge to Trump. It was a politely worded patriotic challenge. Like, are you really going to go after me when the hypocrisy and the cruelty is so blatant? Like, are you actually going to do this? And of course, the answer is yes. And, you know, Trump sees no problem in this and parading it around as propaganda. But, you know, it was a way of telling the truth that I've seen when I study currently authoritarian states, where people feel in testimony that they can't directly express what they want to say. They can't directly critique the regime or criticize the leader, but they can make, you know, a moral plea, and they can make a plea that references the constitutions, you know, of those countries that are never actually practiced on paper, because a lot of people forget that. They forget that authoritarian states often have democratic constitutions. Like, on paper, freedom of speech is guaranteed, corruption is banned, you know, all these things that never play out in day-to-day reality. But that becomes then like a subversive rallying cry for a political opposition actually seeking democracy. And, you know, and I got elements of that from Vindman, you know, who's like the furthest thing from some sort of radical. You know, he's former military, he's, you know, a government public servant. But in this climate, with the Trump administration, he becomes that. And that is just, it's such a Soviet thing. Like, it reminds me so much of the Soviet Union and of the successor states that continued the brutal practices of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and the statement here, right matters, is another one of those things, because this isn't right. Him being fired, and I know the White House say, well, he didn't get fired, he just got rotated out early. And then Trump comes out and says, well, you know, they might go after him. And fortunately the army came out the next day and said, no, there are no investigations. He will be rotated out. He'll do something else, and we'll move him into one of the army colleges. That'll be fine. We're not going after him. Stop that.
Yeah, I don't know how long that will last. I mean, I think there are plenty of people working in different government agencies and working in the military who don't want to carry out these orders. You know, right. They recognize them as unfair and autocratic. But the way that we are headed, especially if Trump gets a second term, you know, that's going to go out the window. They'll either just fire the people who are hesitant to follow illegal orders from the government, or they won't care. Like, people, as they become more fearful and as they become more kind of used to this culture of corruption, of, you know, corruption on a scale we've never seen, they conform. You know, that's also something that is very typical in authoritarian states, especially when they've been there for multiple years. You know, all of these incidents that we're describing 3 years ago would have had people shocked and horrified. And I think, you know, many are still horrified, but pretty much no one is shocked. And honestly, if they express that in a way that they're like genuinely surprised this happened, be like, I have no respect for them, because I just assume, you know, you've been paying no attention at all, because this is what they do. This is who they are. They're not going to change. They're not going to pivot. The only thing we can do is remove them. And the only thing they respond to is indictment or impeachment or other forms of, you know, formal official removal from power, and especially targeting of their ill-gotten gains, of their finances, which are mostly, you know, mafia money, stolen money, laundered money. That's what matters to them, not little, you know, symbolic gestures and so forth.
Yeah, excellent point. Now, before you came on, you tweeted out that if someone wanted to hear you happy, You sound like happy. And so far, you haven't been happy.
Well, you brought me down, man.
I am.
I was on that Warren high, and I came crashing down to earth.
I'm trying to leave this on a happy note. I'm trying to bring you back up. So walk me through this Warren wave.
She was great. I mean, I don't know if you saw the opening of the debate. I'm sure people will be talking about it tomorrow. She spoke in protest to both Trump and Bloomberg. She drew very strong parallels. The people directing the debate were trying not to let her talk. She insisted on having her say. She's been passionate. She's been forthright. I only got to see her answer a second question, but my eyes were welling with tears, which is extremely unusual for me at something like this, like a freaking debate with a politician. That's not the kind of thing I get, in tears for in kind of a genuine way, but she speaks so honestly and so passionately and with such incredible concern about the well-being of ordinary Americans. And we've been deprived of that. Like, we haven't had that in our leadership for so long. People treat us like we're pawns, and they treat this like it's a game and like people are expendable. And it's just obvious from watching her speak how much she sincerely cares about the welfare of the American public. And she's also smart and savvy enough to understand the utter corruption and depravity and brutality at play. She doesn't have blinders on. She's seeing everything very clearly, and she's, persisting, as she says. So, yeah, I mean, I am all in for her. I actually, if she manages to win, I think we have a shot at digging ourselves out of this massive hellhole that we are in. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It doesn't mean she's going to magically turn things around, but she's by far, I think, the best prepared to actually try to do that.
No, I don't have a problem voting for Elizabeth Warren. I've stated, though, before, I'm a Sanders guy. I've been a Sanders person from the beginning because of the vision and the fact that he's built a movement. We may not like some of the people in the movement, of which I find some of the behavior deplorable. But for me, Sanders is right there. I think Sanders and Warren are very close.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad to see that Sanders and Warren fans are uniting against Bloomberg. We have found common cause, and I think that's a very good thing. I think it's sincere. I think Bloomberg is a dire threat, second only to Trump in terms of who's running. He shares a lot of commonalities with it. I think, Warren and Sanders supporters have a lot of commonalities in terms of what they prioritize in policy. If Sanders is the nominee, I will certainly vote for him and encourage other people to vote for him. So, yeah, I mean, I think we know who our enemies are in this situation, and it is this corrupt, cruel billionaire class, whether they are mafia-style billionaires or technocratic billionaires like Bloomberg. That is who we are up against as ordinary Americans, and, I think hopefully we'll be able to rally together, to get those people away from political power.
Yeah, and as I've been saying, I think Tom Perez has to resign. I think he's handled this incredibly badly. I think he's got to go. In fact, I don't know why Bloomberg is on the stage. He's not even on the ballot for Nevada.
Yep.
I mean, it's just that kind of crazy. And the other part of this is I think Bloomberg gets crushed in the general because of all the baggage that he's got. Millennials aren't going to vote for him. Minorities aren't going to vote for him. I don't know that labor is really going to jump in and vote for him. I just don't see it.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think he is the weakest. I mean, he's the worst on a moral level. But it's at a practical level. If you're just thinking who is the most likely to beat Trump, it is not him for all of the reasons that you just said. He's going to depress turnout enormously, and we need high turnout for a variety of reasons, not just, for the sheer defeating Trump as if it's a free and fair election. We should expect massive voter suppression. We should expect every dirty trick. And one of the few things we can do is turn out in droves. And it will be very, very hard for a lot of people, millions and millions of people, to vote for Bloomberg, including me. Like, I've been thinking in my head, if it comes down to this, like, my God, like, I don't think I could imagine feeling worse about, a vote I've cast in my life, if I'm forced to vote for Michael Bloomberg. I mean, it's just, oh, God, he's evil. Like, he is corrupt and disgusting. And we just did a Gaslit Nation episode listing all of the reasons that he is a dangerous potential president, that he's a threat the democracy, that he's an American oligarch. And so hopefully folks can listen to that, because now you have utterly killed my Warren high. So I need to get back in my previous state of mind, because if I think about Bloomberg, I'm just going to like explode on the spot.
No, and so. this is a perfect spot, because look, this is exactly how I think a lot of folks on the left are going to feel. Because, you know, you've got Warren, you've got Sanders. You could even say, no, I can't say anybody else. That have a clear vision of how we move the country forward. Not just about beating Trump. Yeah, that's really, really important. That's issue number one. But issue two, three, and four are just as important. Healthcare, education, infrastructure, you know, go down the list. And I want somebody who's actually going to have a real good plan to move us forward and get people excited about going out to vote. I don't see anybody else that brings that kind of juice.
No, I don't either. I mean, I think the others that aren't Bloomberg will get more of the sort of, you know, voter that just really wants Trump out but isn't happy about the candidate. Like, I could vote for the rest of them, for Biden, Klobuchar, Buttigieg, whatever. I will cast that vote. Bloomberg is like a whole nother category. But yeah, it's very hard for me to imagine, you know, people not just voting, but doing like the canvassing, the volunteering, speaking out with sincerity on behalf of a candidate. Like, that's often very hard to do. Like, back in 2018, people kept asking me to speak out for Claire McCaskill. And I did say, you know, in Missouri, and I did say, yes, of course you should vote for her, because the Senate is a body and the Democrats need to dominate it, because that's how votes are cast and so forth. It was extremely hard for me to make a credible case for her as a candidate, because she had said a lot of offensive things and done a lot of offensive things. And she ended up losing in part because she alienated not just people like me, but especially Black people from Missouri and especially Black women. Like, she literally was calling people who lived in cities in a kind of, you know, thinly veiled slur, crazy. And I see that same problem with Bloomberg, where he has, you know, alienated the base of the Democratic Party. He was a Republican for most of his life. And, you know, it would be disastrous. And I also worry about him running third party, but I'll save that for another time and hopefully for never.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. But here's the thing. You talked about energy there a second ago. His money seems to be buying up a lot of that.
Oh, absolutely. It's disgusting. I mean, even my children, they see his ads when they're watching, like, YouTube gaming videos, like, about Minecraft. Like, he's doing things. He's targeting everyone. He's targeting kids. So they go and repeat lies to their parents, like, Obama endorsed Bloomberg. Like, my 9-year-old told me that because he saw it in a Bloomberg ad. And I was like, no, he did not.
Nope.
We had a little lesson about political propaganda. But, you know, he is doing that. He's bathing the country in his ads. He has spent more, I think, than any candidate in the history of the United States already, and he's yet to win a single vote. He has not been on the ballot, and it's gross. You know, everything about this, the late entry into the race, the fact that the DNC bent the rules for him, the fact that he believes he can buy this election, and that so many pundits on TV are just cheering that along. Like, that's a good thing. You know, I don't think even now they realize the threat of oligarchy and the threat of dark money and the threat of billionaires. But look at countries that have this kind of system. You know, look at Ukraine or look at Russia. Look what's happened over the last few decades. And, you know, and look at countries in the West that have had this kind of undue influence. And look at the United States. This is kind of like the ultimate example of how money corrupts in politics. And the Democratic Party ostensibly is supposed to be the party that stands against that. And instead, they are, you know, in an act of total cowardice, embracing that kind of, you know, blatant manipulation. And it's so gross. And everyone should just reject it. Reject Mike Bloomberg.
That's why I'm hoping in Nevada they vote for Sanders for me, obviously Warren for you, and anybody else but Bloomberg. Don't write his name. And he's not even on the ballot. But we'll see how this plays out. Sarah, I appreciate the time, the thoughts. I hope you can leave on a high.
Yes, I'm going to go back to that debate. It's the first time I've kind of looked forward to a debate in a while.
Good stuff.
So I'll see what happens. Hopefully Bloomberg's getting smacked down.
Terrific. Right. Thank you, Sarah. Appreciate the time. Our good friend Sarah Kendzior. Make sure you check out her podcast, Gaslit Nation, one of the best out there. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.